And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. We know it's impossible to see into the future. Most cultures have respect for those with knowledge and with expertise and with experience acquired through a long life. Though it's also true that some of us only respect views in harmony with our own. Economists posit or imagine future scenarios based on past and current events, theories, and models. Farmers put their faith in experience, science, hard work, and God. Well, some at least put their faith in God. Now, just imagine how powerful a combination such an economist and such a farmer would be. Well, I have one sitting in front of me on his Zoom screen right now. He's Dan Bass, president of Ag Resource in Chicago, and that's where he is today. Dan Bass is a guru in the field of grains and softs, and I'll ask him to explain what softs are. He's been an advisor to almost 50 governments over decades. His credentials are impressive and his reputation global. We're going to talk about the present difficulties of the grain industry and food in general, and you must surely be aware of it. The war in Ukraine, chronic drought in so many parts of the world, and of course, climate change. I want to get a better understanding of what's going on for my own enlightenment and for yours too, dear listeners. Dan Bass, welcome to the McKay Interview. Thanks for making time for me and for our listeners.
Michael, thank you, Mr. McKay. It's good to be with you, and I'm looking forward to discussing the world of food over the next 30, 35 minutes.
Dan, we were last together. Please call me Michael, Dan. It's a more relaxed form for the interview. Dan, we were last together in person just over a month ago when you passed through Geneva, and your memorable speech to the British Swiss Chamber of Commerce was outstanding and very well received. I have a mixture of simple and complex questions to ask you, but first, what are softs?
Well, softs has been a name given to commodities that are not something you can hold in your hand and drop on your foot, like a bar of gold. They are things that we consume, whether it be the shirts on our backs, the food that goes in our mouth, or maybe potentially even the biofuels that go in our automobiles. So these are the things that ingrain softs, which can be tropical in nature, but also can be as much as, a food grain like wheat that's grown up in Siberia.
Okay, so it's actually quite a wide-ranging term.
It is a wide-ranging term. Yeah. It's something that's not industrial. When you think about metals or energy, we think about industrial. Soft really highlights the commodities that we utilize every day in our daily lives.
I see. Now, Dan, I've read that there are some critical issues concerning crop yields. What is your assessment of the current situation regarding grain production and supply?
Well, last year, Michael, was the first year that the world consumed more grain than it produced. This hasn't happened before in history unless there's been a dramatic series of weather calamities that causes crops to fail. So last year, we didn't have a big crop failure. There were a few issues around the world, but still the world consumed more than the record grain crop than we produced. So humankind is coming to a point now in which its caloric intake is surpassing available arable land. And so yields need to kick up a step or two, or we need to bring more land into production to keep up with the general profile that's going on with people having more disposable income. And of course, now in post-COVID days, looking at consuming more food because we're sitting at home.
So I had in mind to ask you, why are we here? But you've really answered my question already in that respect. But just to give me a sense of how serious, how critical things really are today.
Well, kind of, Michael, it depends on where you're sitting around the world. If you're sitting in a country in Africa or Southeast Asia, or maybe even Latin America, where you're spending 50 to 70% of your disposable income on food, it's very critical. I mean, that's where every 1% gain or 2% loss becomes very important to your availability of income. Now, if you're sitting in the United States, where we only spend 6.7% of our disposable income on food, maybe not so much. And so it all depends on where you're resting. But we're concerned about the impoverished in the world, that 2 million people that get by with less than $3 a day in terms of their intake. And so those are the folks that initially will be on the front line of what we consider to be this developing food shortage that will likely go on for at least several years.
I know this sounds like a simplistic question, Dan, but what needs to happen to rebalance the ship?
Well, one of the things that's happening that's very concerning to Ag Resource and myself is that global grain yields have stopped moving up. Now, we think of technology as always increasing everything that we consume. In the case of grain, though, yields have stagnated. And this puzzled me for now the last 2 or 3 years. What's going on? What am I missing? Farmers are still applying the same amount of fertilizer, in some cases more. We've got technological advances in seed and chemicals, yet crop yields have stagnated. And it really came down to weather.
Michael. And you're talking globally now, not just in the United States.
I am talking globally. I'm looking at global corn, soybean oil, wheat, canola, or rapeseed, as it's called in the EU, oats, barley, crops that are utilized for many purposes of feeding livestock or feeding humans. And today, the yields on those collective crops have plateaued. Not only have they plateaued today, but they've now plateaued. This will be the fifth year in a row. So to get rid of the problem that I have, in other words, bring more food on, I need more acres. So we are calculating in the next 5 years that the world needs to bring on somewhere between 23 and 25 million extra acres to just fulfill the additionality in terms of caloric intake of more people and better demographics.
And what kind of percentage would that be? When you mentioned a number that big, but in terms of percentage of what exists already, what kind of increase are you looking for then?
Well, it would be about twofold from our past history. So if we think about what we usually bring into production, unless there's a demand driver, like let's say biofuels, after biofuels, we saw a big increase in global acreage because of the need by governments to have it, of course, in our fuel supplies. That all changed back in 2013, and we then went sideways. But now we're on this new demand driver again, China being an importer of corn, changes in the global consumption patterns after COVID. And this has now taken us to this spot where I need world acreage or world farmers to bring in twice the amount they normally would. And here's my dilemma. That when I think about the world, we in the United States were part of the additionality and bringing in those acres in the last few years. We've now maxed out acres in the United States. We are at peak farmland. We're at peak farmland in Europe. So these new acres now have to come from the Black Sea, which is problematic due to the Russian war, or maybe down in South America, which is where we think most of them will come from. But that means that the deforestation, environmental concerns are going to rise very quickly again as we think about the next 2 to 3 years.
So let me be sure I understand you, Dan. You're saying that we need to double the amount of acreage that we have at present in order to move forward and to supply the population. Double the amount of acreage.
That's right. We need to double the past trends. And we need to be quicker about happening. And somewhere, if you really want to get somewhat real concerned about agricultural life, somewhere between 2050 and 2062, we reach peak farmland globally. So there will be no additionality acres to bring into production. Now, that's a ways down the tracks, I understand, when you think about, 30 years from now, 35 years from now. But for humankind and where we're at and what we will need thereafter, it is all going to be about yields and different farming methods and different ways of thinking about food than where we have been before. So there's a big change going on in agriculture. This is not something that will be, a decade or two. This will be something very lasting as we look into the 21st century.
So let's just roll back a little bit then and just talk again in a little bit more detail, a little bit more depth about yields, because obviously most people listening to this program are not experts like you. Just talk a little bit more about how one increases the level of yield from land, from soil, given the fact that there is a lot of concern about the way in which land is being treated.
Well, I always say it that we know more about what's 200 or 300 miles above our head than what's 2 feet under our feet. And so, soil health is becoming something that's becoming a brand new field and very, very important to food production. And so as we understand microbes and we understand nutrients and the availability of what it means for organics and organic matter in soil, this will all build yields going forward. Today, unfortunately, we're very reliant on fertilization. In other words, potash, nitrogen, phosphate to bring crop yields up, and farmers put more of it on. The Green Revolution was really about more water through irrigation, more chemicals through herbicides, and of course, more fertilization. That's what Norman Borlaug did in terms of getting that revolution going this next revolution will be more about land. We don't have a green revolution that we can do anymore. So we need to think about more land availability, bringing farmland in. That will take some of that land out of areas that are environmentally challenged. But I also would say that for the marketplace and for you and I thinking about our food budgets and availability, this will be something that will be important as we think about the next 10 to 20 years.
And clearly there are sort of huge social and political concerns in what you just said. Probably we don't understand the ramifications completely.
Oh, we will not. I mean, this is will be constantly changing, just like higher energy prices. These are things in the transformation over to a different energy source. These will be things that humankind will have to walk through very carefully. And unfortunately, politicians, not, you know, with the main job being reelected in the next term, aren't giving us the vision that needs to be applied in terms of how to think about different agronomic practices, thinking about, you know, different energy sources and all of that. So policy becomes a very big component of our futures as we think about food availability and energy availability looking into 2030 and 2040.
And tell me a little bit more about how market forces work in the important food commodity sector. And you touched on it, and obviously we have to discuss it in our conversation, what the impact of the war in Ukraine caused by the illegal invasion of Russia. Tell me a little bit more about how you see it sitting from your desk and the way you look at the world. Market forces.
Well, you know, the Ukrainians and the Russians, let's call them the Black Sea, if you will.
Yeah.
For about 29% of world from wheat production.
29%.
29%.
Yeah.
Over 80% of sun oil. I know it's a specific vegetable oil, if you will, but they were very big in sunflower seed and sun oil production. Very important to the world, that 81%. And then as you think of some of the other crops like barley, we're in that 27 to 28%. So the Black Sea is king in the world of grain, barley, and wheat. And so that those are the two commodities that will be most impacted as we go forward. I have no idea, Michael, when the war will be over, but this war looks to us to be somewhat extended. As long as the West keeps sending weaponry to our friends in Ukraine and the Russians are there, we fear that the Ukrainians will fight to the last man, and this will have some longevity. And our concern is maybe not with this year's wheat crop in Ukraine, because it is now being harvested. That was planted last winter. The concern is for crops forthcoming, because there's not enough diesel, there's not enough fertilizer, there's not enough seed to get crops in the ground. So it's 2023 and beyond that the Black Sea really has a big impact on world agricultural prices and those that need food, particularly in Southeast Asia and those impoverished countries we talked about earlier.
And I imagine there's just no substitute for that.
And there really isn't. I mean, bread is a staple of life.
Mm.
We can use a little potato here or there. We can use maybe some synthetic gluten, but if you need, whether it be flatbread or leavened bread, there's just really no other place to get it from. So, when you think about particularly the countries like Egypt, which is a big bread consuming country, the pressures financially and on supply will be sizable going forward.
And we can't have a conversation about this without talking about China, its vast population, and what role China plays in the current food situation.
Well, China's a biggie, and the Chinese have been very wise over the years to, of course, nail down or put aside huge stores of grain for their own population. China has over 50% of the world wheat stores today. So if you think about where supplies could come from, one place would be China, but they are not willing exporters of grain due to the problems in the Black Sea. The one change in China, though, is that their hog herd is now recovering from African swine fever. So they need more feed grains. And not long ago, the Chinese banned the feeding of food waste to hogs. This comes from restaurants or your back of your kitchen. That was over 40 million metric tons of food waste that is not being fed because it spread the disease, African swine fever. Today, that's all being replaced by corn and soy meal, westernized diets, if you will, if you're a hog consumer. So those are the big changes that are forthcoming. But I believe the Chinese will be on an elevated import campaign here to just make sure their reserves and their food security is in place over the next couple of years.
So if I understand you, Dan, you're saying that even though they've got a very comfortable cushion of reserves, they will still be seeking to import supplies during the next 12 to 24 months?
There's no doubt. China is active in the markets almost daily. They are buying soybeans. They have a record export program of soybeans out of the United States. They will be looking at bringing in vegetable oils and grains. China will be the world's largest importer of soybeans, taking over two-thirds of its supply. And in the terms of the grain markets, China will import one out of every 4 million metric tons of grains traded in the world. So they are by far the biggest. And China shows no willingness to back down at all from those prospects of food security. The Chinese government knows that it's the most important ingredient in terms of their political system.
I see. Dan, I just want to ask you a question in four parts about action and behavior, particularly with the G7 meeting in mind taking place right now as we speak. What should wealthy governments do? This is the first part. What should wealthy governments do? What should poorer countries do? What should farmers do? And what should food manufacturers do about this current crisis?
And Michael, I may add consumers to that list also, and we can go to that lastly. But
yes, I'm coming to that in a moment. Yeah.
In terms of governments, the first thing they can do is think about, and the debate is ongoing with G7 about the fuel versus food debate. We use a tremendous amount of corn, and in the case of Europe, vegetable oils in the production of biofuels. Can we relent? Can, of course, for now, governments send the right message that food is more important than fuel. Now, we do have an energy crisis along with a food crisis, so you're going to have to pick your villain. But that is one thing governments could do. And I do believe that Europe is taking the lead. The United States has already backed out and said that because of climate change, we believe that biofuels will be all important here in the United States as a stepping stone to electrification. In terms of what farmers can do, they can maximize their productivity. By that, I'm saying, look at planting every arable acre, look at utilizing technology, whether it's through seed, agronomic practices, such as fertilization or herbicides, to get their maximum yields. And the market's trying to encourage that with very high prices, not only today, but for the next 5 years as we look at the futures market.
Can I just stop you there? And rich countries like America, Canada, EU countries, they could even do better?
Much better. Much better. We still have some gains to come. We still can see yield improvement. We can still use different tillage practices and different methodologies. We can take better care of our soils. We can plant cover crops.
What's that?
Cover crop would be a crop that would get planted in September, October in the Northern Hemisphere and give us an oilseed or another crop in the spring, boosting productivity, kind of a double crop, if you will, such that there will be availability of two crops in the same growing cycle. So the market needs to encourage it. Policy needs to encourage it. By that, I'm saying governments. Today, we're not there yet because prices aren't high enough, long enough, but I do think we'll make it to those kind of situations.
And what are food manufacturers, the big processors and food manufacturers, what role should they play in this?
Well, they need to be as cognizant as they can about the size and portion size. We have a problem in the United States about big portions. We have an obesity problem in the United States. Maybe it's instead of having a 12-inch can of Coca-Cola, it should be 8 ounces. There's different ways to back down and to do things. And as food prices rise, you find consumers trailing off and looking to more quality. So they should be looking at more quality products and maybe not all the starch that many of the people would be looking at today.
So those were the means and the power and the will to alter their eating habits should really make a concerted effort to do so. Or am I asking too much of people?
Well, no, you're asking something that the market is trying to prod them into already. I mean, food prices are rising for reasons of scarcity. As the market continues to rise, you'll find the next jolt in the food supply coming not from the grains, but coming from the meat sector. Cattle, hog, poultry prices will be probably record high in 2023. And that's because of high grain prices. As you get high grain prices, margins slip in livestock profitability. And so the next cycle will take meat prices to record highs, which should nudge people to maybe consume a little less.
Thanks. My guest today is Dan Bass, president of Ag Resource. He's one of the global authorities on grains, softs, and the food industry. And he's in Chicago, and we're talking on Zoom. Dan, for the second part of the show, let's look at some other aspects that are no less important. Firstly, ethanol for fueling cars versus ethanol for feeding people. Please explain the dichotomy as you see it.
Well, we in the United States use 40% of our corn crop for the production of fuel, ethanol. And today, because of policy, U.S. cars would have difficulty running on an oxygenate, but that's what ethanol does, is add an O2 component to the fuel supply without it. And so as you think about moving towards a future of electric cars, we probably will start to back down on ethanol. However, there's a new industry that is now stepping forward that needs the ethanol, which is called the airline industry. Sustainable aviation fuel, called SAFE, SAF, is going to be something that will consume tremendous amounts of ethanol going forward. Of course, no one wants to be in a battery-operated plane. And so as we think about the future of fuel, that component is very, very important. Now, we can also make ethanol and other things from wood refuse and other things. Do we have to be using grain? That's a big question that I think the chemists need to be asking going forward.
And is it just a matter of chemists dealing with that? Or is there another dimension to this argument that can, in a way, save what apparently seems to be quite not a wasteful use of resources, but an unattractive way of using scarce resources?
Well, that's right. I mean, for many years before ethanol, before the U.S. lobby and agriculture got very strong, we used something called methanol.
Yes, I remember.
Methanol was another product we put in the gasoline supply for the same components, the oxygenate, if you will. It can be brought back. It can be brought back in a safer method because we found methanol did have some carcinogenic issues. But I'm now told that you can chemically bring it back in a safer venue. So maybe there's ways to look at organic waste or wood waste or other things that could give us the same kind of production of biofuels that we have today. Unfortunately, the industry on biofuels is very politically strong and very well attached. And so this will take a long period and some real adversity in terms of the world food supply before we get there. But there are alternatives. We didn't get back to the consumer, and I'm going to take you back there.
Please do that.
Which is the other thing, which is in the United States and throughout much of the world, we waste anywhere between 19 and 27% of our food supply.
It's a scandal.
It is a scandal. Mm. And somehow that needs to change, and high prices and thoughtfulness in terms of what we're preparing, when we're preparing, and how we're consuming our food will be very important in the future. So the market is trying to take the cost of you letting a banana rot or not finishing your plate at dinner to be much higher than it was before. Leftovers are probably something we should enjoy going forward.
Well, that's what we had when I was a child anyway. If we didn't eat it today, we got it back the next day. Dan, there's something I wanted to ask you, and you mentioned this when you were in Geneva, that's labor, people who work on the land, attracting workers to farming, which is hard work. What's the situation around the world about attracting young men and young women to the farming industry?
It's been very difficult, Michael. The aspect of going to the farm, rural places around the world, whether it be Australia, America, even portions of Europe, is unattractive for many. It's not been seen as a high-tech job. It's been seen as a brack-baking, a labor of love, if you will.
But it is in many countries, surely. It is. That is a fact, isn't it, Dan?
It is a fact. Yeah. It is. However, in the United States or many developed countries, if you will, agriculture will need many more workers. We are short of workers today. We can hope that technology, whether it be robotics to milk cows or plant seeds or weed fields, will come along. But it's probably 5 or 10 years away. But we have a labor shortage in many areas of the world, which I don't think will resolve itself. Thankfully, where we need the extra acres down in South America, they will have more abundance of labor. But again, when we think about this, this is a capital business also. To buy a tractor these days will cost anywhere between $300,000 and $500,000. Combines are now selling for $700,000. So as you think about the cost of capital and the producing of agriculture, as interest rates rise, labor and capital become two components that will be restrictive on future production.
I see. Dan, I wanted to ask you before we close a rather personal question. You talk in your speeches, and I heard you say this, about Mother Nature and God. And that's relatively unusual nowadays for a businessman or an economist. What role does faith play in your life, both as a farmer and as an economist?
Well, listen, in years of drought, I go to church with an umbrella so that we can try to pray for rain. Listen, in the world of agriculture, God is everywhere. We see it in the birthing of calves or lambs or pigs. We see it in the production of a seed germinating and growing, and we are very blessed. I mean, if we think about all of our lives, it really comes down to the top 6 or 8 inches of soil globally for our existence here on the planet. And so if I think about the importance of that top or 6, 8 inches, and then the rain or sunshine that falls upon the land, those are gifts that are given from someone above. And so in agriculture, it's hard to get away from what we would call a God presence, Michael.
You put it so eloquently, and I agree with you, Dan. Last question. What ought we to do to plan and prepare for a better future as far as food cultivation and production are concerned? What is your call to action?
Well, I think all of us need to think differently a little bit about food. If you can help yourselves by having a little backyard garden, if you can have a vertical garden in your kitchen in which there may be lights growing herbs or microgreens or something like that, it's a way to step into the world of agriculture and be a helping hand. I think going forward, we all need to think about our own crops, where they come from, how we can best consume them, and who has control of them. Increasingly, reliability of suppliers will be a question we will be asking for years to come. So this food debate we're now having, we've been blessed, but it's something that is going to be tugging at an ever-expanding and growing world.
Dan, it's been an education and a pleasure listening to you. Many thanks for answering all my questions so clearly and patiently. My guest today has been Dan Bass, president of Ag Resource and one of the global authorities on grains, softs, and the food industry. Thanks so much, Dan.
You're welcome, Michael. Have a great day.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.